Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Ray DeMonaco. He is the Director of Education Policy at the Manhattan Institute. He's taught education research and policy at Brooklyn College and Baruch College in New York. And he has served in different research and advisory positions in the New York City public school system. Welcome, Mr. DeMonaco.
Glad to be here.
All right. Well, our topic here is a little piece you wrote in the Wall Street Journal, and then it was republished in City Journal. It was in August, and it was entitled, quote, "Consign James Blaine to Memory Lane." And so this is a strong assertion here that you say comes out of the prospect of something happening next year in the Supreme Court that will affect religious schools. As we get to that, why don't we start with some background and tell us, who was James Blaine?
So James Blaine was a congressman from the state of Maine in the 1870s. At one point, he unsuccessfully ran for president. But the background here is that in the late 19th century, the late 1800s, with large-scale Irish Catholic immigration to the United States, there was a backlash. There were people who were not pleased to see these Catholic immigrants coming into the country. So actually, it was President Ulysses S. Grant who first proposed a constitutional amendment in 1875 to ban use of any public money for sectarian or religious schools. This was really targeted at Catholic schools because prior to this time, it was not true, as many people mistakenly believe, that public schools were completely devoid of religious content. In one famous case in Massachusetts, Catholic students were disciplined very severely because they refused to read from the King James version of the Bible, which was not the sanctioned version of the Catholic Church. So Bible studies and other religious aspects were in American public schools. But with the arrival of Irish immigrants, there was a pushback.
I thought that the Constitution, in the Bill of Rights, it says that there must be a wall of separation between church and state. That was in 1787, 89. Isn't that written into the Constitution?
Not the concept of the wall of separation between church and state. There are two aspects of the Constitution. Actually, my contention in my reading of history, that wall gets constructed around the time that I'm talking about here, the late 19th century. So in 1875, I think it was yet to be U.S. President Rutherford B. Hayes, told Blaine that the Republican Party had been losing strength in his state of Ohio for several years by Republican farmers leaving the state to be replaced with, quote, Catholic foreigners. We shall, and he argued that it would be politically advantageous for the Republican Party to come out against public funding of religious, parentheses, Catholic schools, because this would gain them political points with the anti-immigrant vote, which was quite large. Ironically, Blaine himself, his parents were, I guess, what you would call a mixed marriage. His mother was Roman Catholic. His father was Presbyterian. His parents were married in the Catholic Church. But in one reading that I've seen, their compromise was that the sons, including Blaine, were raised Presbyterian, and his sisters, the girls in the family, were raised Roman Catholic. But despite this background, despite the fact that his mother and his sisters were Catholic, he saw some political expediency here. So then he formally proposed in the Congress this constitutional amendment to block any public funding of sectarian schools. That effort failed. Congress never approved that. They never sent that to the states, which is how the U.S. Constitution gets amended. But it was actually so popular, 38 of the existing 48 states at the time wrote into their state constitutions these things that are now called Blaine Amendments that have wording that says essentially that no money raised by taxation by the state for the support of public schools or any other public funds should ever be under the control of any religious sect in their schools. And so that is, there's a long history here, but that is the basis of this case that is coming before the Supreme Court.
Well, before we get to that, let me ask you one thing, a historical question. So the Blaine Amendments cut off funding for sectarian schools, and that was mostly Catholic schools. Did it also ask that public schools remove all religious Protestant content from the classroom?
No, the amendment did not, but I think it was all part of a whole at that time, perhaps for the first time in American history, seeing, you know, Catholics coming to the country. There was a concern about this, and so part of the larger effort at that time was to roll back, religion in the public schools. I'm not completely up on the history, but I believe it's actually not until the 1950s or 1960s where you see outright bans on things like prayer in public schools and other such things.
Yeah, I imagine that the idea of getting King James out of classrooms, you know, teaching the ABCs through little pieces of King James in 1890, that would have caused riots.
One would think, yes.
Indeed. Okay, so the Montana case. What is the Montana case that the Supreme Court has decided to accept?
Right. So Montana is one of the states that has a Blaine Amendment in its constitution. But in 2015, Montana, the legislature enacted and the governor signed a law creating a tax credit for taxpayers who were contributing to scholarship organizations that were providing scholarships for students to attend private, including religious schools. All right, there are a number of states that have these tax credit programs. And part of the legal thinking behind the tax credit approach is even in states where there is a prohibition on funding of religious schools, that in a tax credit, the money is not going directly from the state to the religious or private school. And what people get a credit on their taxes for is money that they contribute to a nonprofit private organization. That organization then funds and provides scholarships to students. So the thinking there is that since it's not going directly from the government treasury to the private schools, it's a workaround to these prohibitions. And in a number of states, there are existing programs like that. Illinois, 2 years ago, passed a similar bill. So in parts of Illinois now, students attending Catholic and other religious schools, if they meet certain requirements, are able to get scholarships, and that the people who fund those scholarships get a credit for that on their taxes. So anyway, so Montana passes this law in 2015. They turn it over to the State Department of Finance to implement because it's a tax credit. The finance department manages the tax system. So they will be the ones who will be issuing checks or giving credit for the taxes to the taxpayers. But when the State Department of Finance got their hands on it, they added a regulation that said no contributions made to support scholarships for kids in religious schools could receive the tax credit, and they cited that state's Blaine Amendment.
Who instituted this? After the legislature passed this, I mean, what is the basis for the a bureaucrat stepping in this way?
Because that's what bureaucrats do. Their reading of the Montana State Constitution was that these could not go to religious schools. This is why we have courts, right? So immediately, parents who had their children in religious schools went to court, supported by some organizations. But in the question you raised before about the separation, the wall of separation, when the parents went to court, they cited their U.S. Constitutional rights to the free exercise of religion.
Mm-hmm.
All right. The trial court, the first court in Montana, agreed with the parents. But when it got to the highest court in Montana, the state Supreme Court, they overturned that decision, ruling in favor of the Department of Finance, saying that the Department of Finance had correctly interpreted the Montana state constitution. And they went even further. They knocked down the entire tax credit program for both religious and non-religious private schools because of the inclusion of religious schools in the legislation.
Was this a popular decision in the state of Montana?
I haven't been. Montana is a pretty small state, but what's important here is that the parents of students in religious schools kept up the fight. They didn't drop it there. But before we get on to the Supreme Court, it's worth noting that this whole hullabaloo is about something that does not involve large amounts of money. The tax credit that anyone would receive under the law as constructed by the Montana State Legislature was capped at $150 per individual per year. And the scholarships that would be granted to students in private or religious schools were capped at half the average annual state spending per pupil on public schools. So we're talking about very small dollars here. The scholarships would only provide half of what the public schools were spending in that state. And the benefit to anyone who was actually getting this tax credit was minuscule, $150 a year. But I guess there was a high principal at stake, so people took the positions that they did.
And the Montana Supreme Court was relying on the Montana's version of the Blaine Amendment.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. So now the parents in Montana have brought the petition to the U.S. Supreme Court to consider this whole decision. And the Supreme Court, at the end of the last term in June, agreed to hear this case in the year that actually begins today, October 1st for the Supreme Court. So sometime between now and June, they will hear arguments in this case and presumably render a decision. The legal issue here is quite tightly defined, and that is, did the Montana Supreme Court's decision to strike down the scholarship program because it includes religious schools violate the U.S. Constitution's protections for religious liberty contained in the Free Exercise Clause, the Establishment Clause, and the Equal Protection Clause? Okay, so they're going to review the logic and the interpretation of the law on the part of the Montana Supreme Court and test it against provisions for the free exercise of religion and equal protection under the U.S. Constitution.
It seems to me that common sense says that you're giving money for private schools. From there, parents can choose. And this is not a state establishment of religion in any way. Just because money originates from a tax write-off or a tax deduction and goes through then the private sector to private families and then ends up, or some portion of it ends up in a religious school, that seems to be a kind of absolutist definition of that wall, which it's not even in the Constitution, this phrase about wall of separation. And I would think that common sense and a lot of people who got the tax credit who didn't go to religious school, send their kids to religious schools, they must have been pretty angry when the court invalidated the whole thing.
So, I'm neither a lawyer nor a judge, but I think I'm going to declare you guilty of using common sense because
sorry.
People have very strong opinions about this, and I would argue that the Blaine Amendment, the actions of the Montana Department of Finance, are part of a larger whole that we see of hostility towards religious schools. It's worth noting that soon in the years after the Blaine Amendment, in the 1920s, the state of Oregon tried to ban religious schools outright. They tried to say that parents were required under the compulsory education law to send their children to the public schools. And so this would have disestablished religious schools. In a very famous Supreme Court case, Pierce versus the Society of Sisters in 1925, the U.S. Supreme Court rules, no, children are not owned by the state. Parents have rights, and among their rights are the right to choose a religious or private school for their children. So it's because of that case that came out of another attempt to limit parental choice to only to public schools that parents enjoy the right, to send their children to school that reflect their religious or other beliefs. And, so that right is clear. Although I think there are probably some today, some public school advocates who would try and challenge that. But this case before the Supreme Court this year is about whether any money can flow to support those schools.
In your experience of the education system, are the objections to programs like this one, are they principled objections to religious schooling because they regard it as a form of indoctrination or proselytizing? Are they based on that principle, or is it a more cynical objection to resources being directed away from the public schools to somewhere else?
Though the legal issue here is rather tightly defined, and that's what the court will rule on, the issues of policy, particularly educational policy, go much deeper. In direct answer to your question, I don't think this is about resources. I mean, the resources
they're so small in this case, right?
Right. The difference in spending between particularly religious schools of all types, Catholic schools, Jewish schools, other denominations, and public schools. You know, the religious schools are spending less than half of what the public schools are spending. Sometimes the difference is even greater. You know, we do have elite prep schools, independent schools that charge much, much more, but they're smaller in number in terms of how many students. I think that the issues here go to hostility towards values. Some people think of public education almost as America's civic religion, that the public schools are the place where American values are going to be inculcated and where somehow the dominant values of the day are going to be used to produce a new kind of man and woman that are going to reflect those values. The values of the, I use the term values of the day because they change over the decades. But if we look in the current environment, you know, we have a large debate about what will be considered religious or faith or cultural issues in our country that have to do with, basic values. I would argue that parents of all races and cultural backgrounds, religious and non-religious, and poor parents as well as wealthy parents, want some of the same things from their children's schools. Number one, they want their children to be safe. And often, as part of being safe, they want their children to be surrounded by classmates whose families share their values. Now, these may differ. Some people feel very strongly about educational philosophy. Is this a rote learning or a back to basic school, or is it sort of open learning where the kids are exploring and learning on their own? Sometimes it's about the expectations of schooling. Many public school parents, we have a big debate in New York City right now, want their children to only attend, you know, selective, academically selective, or gifted and talented schools. They don't want their children in classrooms that have lower achieving students, for example. Some people prefer a more relaxed approach. You hear parents say, I want my child to be a child when they're 7 or 8 years old. I don't want to be fretting about the incredible competitiveness that one often finds in public school systems, particularly in large cities, that, you know, they have to earn their way into the gifted program or things like that. So people argue or differ about a lot of very valid things. And in a well-ordered system of education, we would allow people to make choices to reflect their own priorities. What we run up against in that argument in religious schools is, quite frankly, some people don't like some of the values that are taught in religious schools. A scholar at Johns Hopkins, Ashley Rogers Berner, has pointed out that we're often given a false dichotomy. She argues, correctly so, that all schools reflect certain values. You can't separate values from education, but the false dichotomy that's offered is a choice between, quote, value-laden private or religious schools and value-neutral public schools. No schools are value-neutral, right? You know, and so that's the reality, and it's what parents want, and we should accept that. And we should allow people to exercise this choice within broad, you know, requirements. The state still has a role to speak about curriculum and things like that. In terms of this hostility towards religious schools, there's a huge debate going on in New York State right now that does not revolve around Catholic schools. It revolves around Jewish schools, because while Catholic schools have been declining in numbers for a long, long time in New York City, we have many Orthodox families, many Hasidic families. They're very large families. There are now 140,000 students in Jewish yeshivas and other type of schools in New York City. Some of these schools serve what people refer to as the ultra-Orthodox or the Hasidic community. And allegations have been made that in some of those schools, particularly high schools that educate boys, the school day is given over entirely to religious instruction, and that the boys are not getting an appropriate level of, say, math or science or social studies. Now, the state of New York has always had a role to look into cases like that. But the state's response now is to issue draft regulations that, A, would affect all private schools in the state, Jewish schools, Catholic schools, and even elite prep schools. And it would empower bureaucrats in the local school districts to make visits to all religious and private schools to determine if those schools are offering a curriculum that is substantially equivalent to what is offered in the public school system.
Ray, can't they just look at test scores?
Not all, in New York State at least, not all private schools are required to give the state tests for one thing. But this issue is not how well the boys are reading. It's what they are and are not being taught. That's what has people up. But the state's action here has actually engendered a huge pushback from representatives of all private and religious schools, who probably would find a lot to disagree with amongst themselves about what schooling should be. But the very wealthy independent prep schools, the Catholic schools, and the Jewish schools are pushing back against the state's regulation or attempt to regulate these schools. The argument is, A, the public schools are not doing such a good job with when you look at test scores. Maybe this is what your question was. The public schools, you know, there are a lot of schools that are not getting kids to any level of acceptable achievement. And B, parents are choosing religious schools or private schools because they want something different from the public schools. And now the state is trying to force them back into that box. This is not an issue that's going to go away. We're going to see this repeated over and over, I believe.
What do you, final question, Ray, what do you think is going to happen in this Montana case when it hits the Supreme Court?
So there are two, one hears two things. Look, it's very hard to predict, and I'm not going to predict what the Supreme Court's going to do. I think they're going to, I'm convinced by reading IBA, they will rule for the parents in Montana. The question is, will they make a very narrow ruling that speaks only to the specifics of this argument of this particular state, or will they take this as an opportunity to knock down the constitutionality of these state-level prohibitions and argue and rule that these are actually impediments to the constitutionally protected right to practice one's religion? I'm hoping it's the latter. I'm hoping that's what we get out of this, but that remains to be seen.
In that court case, a couple of years ago about the playground, right? Was it in Missouri? Where
I believe so, yes.
The court, can you rehearse that case for us? The decision and whether that might give some general indication of the court being broader?
I'm not fully up on the details of that. Some people who've commented on this see this Montana case as the logical next step from that case. Right. So that case did, I believe, rule that it had to do with providing repaving of playgrounds for safety reasons. And I believe they ruled that it was wrong of the state to exclude churches from that. I think the next step here is that, there was no state constitutional prohibition against repaving the parking lots of churches, but in the education realm, many states do have these Blaine amendments, and so that's considered part of the blockade when you bring schools into the question.
Well, it just seems to me that you're discriminating against religious schools when you have a full array of possibilities that parents can choose from, and religion happens to be one of those possibilities, religious schools. You're singling religion out.
Yeah, I would agree, and I would also point out that now I and many people who think like me on this issue are big supporters of charter schools, but the growth of charter schools in this country show that in the realm of public policy, we have begun to accept and fund parental choice of schools. Right. So in New York City now, more than 10% of the children in public schools are in charter schools. And in other cities, it's even greater than that. I believe in Newark, New Jersey, it's over a third of the students, and maybe even more in New Orleans. So we've gone a certain way down this path, saying that, yes, parents have a right to choose from a variety of schools, that we're acknowledging what a lot of the educational research says, that schooling works best when the parent and the school are aligned on what they expect from schools, when there's shared values, and when there is trust between the home and the school and vice versa. So we know all of that. We've written it into law in many states which have charter schools, which are an alternative to traditional public schools. But given that, the treatment of religious schools now stands out in stark relief. Why do we draw the line there? When we know that this is good for children, we know it's good educationally. So I think that's what we're trying to solve in this particular case.
And Mayor de Blasio hasn't been able to slow down the charter movement at all.
Yes, he has supported a block against the creation of more charters in New York City, and unfortunately the state legislature has gone along with him on that.
Okay. Well, we'll see what happens next spring as the term concludes. Thank you, Ray DeMonaco.
Okay, well, thank you for having me.